Imagine holding the deed to thousands of acres of, you know, the most valuable developer-hungry real estate in 1960s New York,
Right.
and deciding to legally engineer a way to give it away so completely that neither you nor your descendants could ever make a dime off it.
It just completely defies logic.
It really does. And welcome to a special deep dive for Destination Hudson Valley's editorial channel, The Edit. You're tuning into a story that is not a hypothetical. Today, we're exploring the Shawangunk Mountains, or the Gunks, as locals call them, and specifically the Mohonk Preserve.
Which is this massive 8,000-acre expanse of pristine nature.
Exactly. And the mission today is to figure out how it survived, because its existence totally defies the standard American narrative of real estate and generational wealth.
It forces you to look at an anomaly. Because, you know, when you see a contiguous block of nature on that sheer scale, you naturally assume, oh, it has to be a state park.
Right, you assume the government stepped in.
Exactly. You assume the state used eminent domain and just drew a massive green box on a map to protect it from developers. But the reality is far more unusual. In 1963, a single Quaker family living in New Paltz took this wildly valuable piece of land and conveyed it into a perpetual nonprofit trust.
Which is wild.
Right. They fundamentally stripped away their own family's right to monetize the ridge, creating what is today the largest nonprofit nature preserve in all of New York State.
I was actually trying to conceptualize how radical that is. And originally, I thought of it like putting a winning lottery ticket in a bulletproof glass box in the center of town.
Oh, that's interesting.
But the more we look at the mechanics of what they actually did, that analogy sort of falls short. It's actually more like writing a revolutionary piece of open source software, but hard coding a rule into the architecture that prevents any future developer, even your own kids, from ever putting it behind a paywall.
That's a great way to frame it, because they built an institution that literally couldn't sell.
Right. But to understand the psychology of locking away a mountain ridge, we have to look well before the 1960s. We have to look at how this family got the land in the first place. And that takes us back to 1869.
Post-Civil War America, yeah. The initial acquisition reveals the whole philosophy that would eventually save the ridge. In 1869, twin brothers, Albert and Alfred Smiley, made their first major move in the Shawangunks.
Okay.
Now, they were Quakers, and they purchased a tavern located at Lake Mohonk.
Okay, wait. Stop right there. Quaker twins buying a tavern.
I know, I
That
know.
sounds like the setup to a historical sitcom. I mean, Quakers are historically known for pacifism and strict temperance, right?
Yes, very strict temperance.
So how does buying a 19th century drinking establishment lay the groundwork for a pristine nature preserve? It
Right.
makes no sense.
Well, the contradiction is exactly what makes the strategy so brilliant. To understand the maneuver, you have to look at what a rural tavern functionally was in 1869. It wasn't just a place to grab a pint of ale. In an era before modern highways or commercial zoning, the tavern was the absolute commercial and social anchor of a region.
It was the hub.
Exactly. It was the nexus where the carriage roads met, where travelers stopped for the night, where local politics were argued. It's where the land was actively managed.
Oh, I see. So it sounds like they bought the tavern not to run it, but to perform a sort of hostile takeover of the area's social anchor. If you control the hub, you control the culture of the mountain.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. The Smiley twins had zero interest in becoming barkeeps.
Right.
They identified the tavern as the strategic center of the landscape, and by purchasing that specific property, they secured the primary access point to the Shawangunks, and they immediately leveraged the irony of the situation.
By shutting down the party.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
They took a space defined by transient, often chaotic behavior, and they systematically dismantled that atmosphere. They banned alcohol, changed the clientele, and began to infuse the property with Quaker values. Yeah, they engineered an environment designed for quiet reflection, deep appreciation for the natural world, and just a profound sense of stewardship.
So they effectively turned the volume down on the entire mountain by taking over the loudest speaker.
That's a great analogy.
They realized that if you want to protect a space, you can't just buy the trees, you have to control the access points. I imagine the local reaction to these wealthy twins rolling in and shutting down the local watering hole must have been mixed, to say the
Oh,
least.
definitely.
Yeah.
But it allowed them to establish a foothold, and it allowed them to dictate the terms of engagement with the land.
Right.
Over the decades, they slowly expanded their holdings, acre by acre. But their vision of stewardship wasn't exclusionary. They didn't build a fortress to keep the public out.
They wanted people to see it.
Yes. They invited people in to experience the restorative power of nature, but strictly on terms that respected the environment. They built these beautiful carriage roads that offered sweeping vistas.
So for a long time, it was a very passive experience.
Exactly. For over half a century, the primary way humans interacted with this land was aesthetic. You walked, you observed, you reflected.
But I mean, controlling the carriage roads didn't protect the Maori from what was coming next. Because the eventual threat to the land didn't come from the roads, it came from the rock faces themselves.
Oh, absolutely.
As we move into the 1930s, the physical reality of the mountain begins to attract a completely different demographic.
Right, because the topography of the Shawangunks is highly unique. You have these incredible, dramatic white cliffs and massive overhangs. And in the 1930s, that specific geology initiated a radical shift in how people utilized the preserve.
The climbers arrive.
Climbers arrive. We see the birth of a serious modern climbing scene pioneered by European climbers who saw the rock not as scenery, but as a vertical playground.
Now, when we talk about the geology drawing these climbers in, the source notes specifically highlight the horizontal quartz conglomerate of the Gunks. Wait, slow down. I need a visual here. What does horizontal quartz conglomerate actually mean for someone staring up at a cliff face? And why does it matter to a climber?
Okay, so if you look closely at the rock in the Shawangunks, it isn't a smooth, sheer face of granite like you might see in Yosemite.
Right, like El Capitan or something.
Exactly. And it isn't soft limestone either. Conglomerate rock is essentially a natural concrete. It's composed of smooth, water-worn pebbles that are bound together by a matrix of quartz cement.
Oh, okay.
Millions of years of geological pressure created it. But the key word here is horizontal.
Horizontal.
Right. The sedimentary layers of this rock form distinct horizontal bands. As those bands weather over time, they create horizontal cracks, fissures, and deep ledges that run parallel to the ground across the cliff face.
So instead of looking for vertical seams to jam your hands into, you're basically looking at a giant staircase of horizontal slots.
Yes, exactly. And that horizontal orientation completely dictated the mechanics of early climbing. Because in the 1930s, climbers didn't have the modern, sophisticated camming devices or lightweight harnesses we have today.
It's way more rudimentary.
Very. They were using heavy hemp ropes, and their primary method of protection involved driving metal spikes, which are called pitons, into the rock with a hammer.
Wow, just hammering spikes into the mountain.
Yep. And the horizontal cracks of the Gunks quartz conglomerate were exceptionally well suited for accepting these pitons, providing really reliable anchor points. The rock itself is incredibly hard, so the gear wouldn't easily rip out if a climber fell.
Which brings us to the individuals who actually figured this out. In 1935, two legendary European climbers arrive on the scene, Fritz Weisner and Hans Krauss.
Right.
They look at this quartz conglomerate, they see the horizontal fissures, and they realize this is an absolute paradise for the techniques they had honed in the Alps.
They did. Weisner and Krauss brought a level of sophistication and daring that just hadn't been seen in the region yet.
Yep.
They weren't just scrambling up the easy routes. They were identifying massive, intimidating cliff faces and methodically conquering them. I mean, they established routes that are still considered rites of passage for modern climbers today.
And we have to pause here because this leads to my absolute favorite piece of trivia from this entire deep dive.
Oh, I knew what you were going to
say. Hans Krauss, this daredevil pioneer, hammering pitons into the Gunks in the 1930s, later goes on to become John F. Kennedy's secret personal physician.
It is wild.
He actually rehabilitated JFK's famously terrible back in secret while Kennedy was running the country. It's one of those historical footnotes that just makes the world feel incredibly small, like Forrest Gump, but with carabiners and pitons.
It's a remarkable connection. And it really underscores the caliber of individuals who were suddenly drawn to the region. The presence of Weisner and Krauss fundamentally changed the relationship between the public and the mountain.
Because climbing is so tactile. Prior to 1935, visitors walked the carriage roads. They looked at the mountain from a distance.
Right.
But climbing requires you to literally bleed onto the rock. You're feeling for handholds. You're memorizing the texture of the quartz. You're intimately studying the geology just to survive the ascent.
Yes.
That shift from passive observation to intense physical interaction must have skyrocketed the perceived value of the land.
It transformed the Shawangunks from a quiet family holding into a crucible for American rock climbing. The secret was out.
But with that comes danger.
Exactly. With that increased love and attention came a severe vulnerability. When an outdoor space becomes famous, it draws traffic. More climbers meant more spectators, more vehicles, and just way more wear and tear on the delicate ecosystem at the base of these cliffs. The mountain was suddenly under physical pressure from its own popularity.
And popularity is a beacon for developers, which perfectly sets the stage for the massive existential choice the Smiley family faced in 1963. The traffic from the climbers was one thing, but the economic landscape of New York in the 1960s was an entirely different monster.
Oh, it was a completely different world. The post-World War II boom completely reshaped the Hudson Valley. You had the aggressive expansion of the interstate highway system.
The Thruway.
Yes, the New York State Thruway suddenly made the Shawangunks highly accessible to millions of people living in New York City. Plus, you had major corporations like IBM building massive campuses in the region, bringing an influx of wealthy professionals. Suburban sprawl was pushing rapidly northward.
So the Smiley family is sitting on thousands of acres of the most desirable, pristine real estate within a couple hours' drive of Manhattan.
Right.
The financial temptation must have been astronomical. You have developers circling, practically salivating over the idea of subdividing the ridge for luxury homes or high-end resorts.
And this is where the foresight of the 1869 tavern acquisition comes full circle. The descendants of the Smiley twins looked at the encroaching suburban sprawl, and they recognized a fundamental truth about human nature.
Which is?
That relying on the goodwill and discipline of future generations is a gamble you will eventually lose.
Wow. Yeah, because even if you raise your children with those strict Quaker values of stewardship, generations dilute.
Exactly.
A great-grandchild might inherit the deed, look at a massive property tax bill, look at a multi-million dollar offer from a developer, and rationalize selling off just 100 acres, and then another 100. The traditional method of passing down a deed with a promise to protect the land is incredibly fragile.
It's the weakest form of conservation. The Smiley family understood that human priorities fluctuate. Economies crash, personal fortunes wane, and individuals become desperate or greedy.
Right.
If the Mohonk Preserve remained private property, it would perpetually be subject to those human vulnerabilities. So in 1963, they made a structural decision.
Yep.
They formally conveyed the land into a perpetual nonprofit trust.
Let's dig into the legal mechanics of that, because the phrase perpetual nonprofit trust sounds like, you know, dry legal jargon.
Sure.
But it is actually the architectural mechanism that saved the mountain. How does a trust legally immunize a piece of real estate against the free market?
Well, when you own a piece of land outright, you hold a bundle of rights. The right to build on it, the right to subdivide it, the right to sell it.
Okay.
When the Smiley family created the trust, they didn't just hand the deed to a new organization. They fundamentally separated the ownership of the land from the right to develop it. A trust is a distinct legal entity governed by a charter. The charter of the Mohonk Preserve legally mandated that the sole purpose of the institution was conservation and education.
So going back to that open source software analogy, they wrote the code for this new institution, and they hard-coded a rule that the land could not be sold for commercial development.
Precisely.
But who enforces that? I mean, what happens if 30 years later, the board of directors of this nonprofit gets corrupted, or they run out of money and they decide to quietly sell a pristine cliff face to her hotel developer?
That is the beauty of the trust structure. Because it's a registered nonprofit trust with a charitable purpose, the board of directors has a strict fiduciary duty to uphold the original charter.
Oh, I see.
If a rogue board attempted to sell the land for development, they would be violating their legal mandate. In New York State, the Attorney General's office has the authority to step in, void the sale, and actually remove the board members for breaching their fiduciary duty.
That is brilliant.
The Smiley family didn't just ask future generations to protect the land, they weaponized state law to ensure it.
They removed human choice from the equation entirely. They recognized that the temptation to monetize the mountain would eventually become too great for any single person to resist, so they built an institution that was legally incapable of selling out.
Exactly.
It takes a staggering amount of humility to admit that you can't even trust your own bloodline with a mountain.
It does. It's the ultimate act of realistic philanthropy. They institutionalized the land to protect it from the fluctuating temptations of the real estate market. This is exactly why it remains New York State's largest nonprofit nature preserve today. They didn't rely on hope. They relied on structural engineering.
It fundamentally changes how you experience the space. When you walk those carriage roads today, or if you're out there climbing the horizontal quartz conglomerate where Hans Krauss used to train, You aren't just benefiting from a geological accident.
No, not at all.
You're benefiting from a massive, invisible legal wall that was built in 1963 to shield the ridge from the modern world's obsession with commodifying everything.
Interest. It's the 1869 ethos, scaled up for the 20th century. The twins bought a tavern to anchor their values, and their descendants built an unbreakable legal framework to ensure those values outlived them all. They totally rejected the prevailing economic premise that the highest and best use of land is commercial development.
They thought in terms of centuries, not financial quarters. And, you know, in a society where every square inch of space, every piece of personal data, and every moment of our attention is assigned a financial value, the existence of an 8,000-acre preserve that legally cannot be bought is just a profound statement.
It challenges the very foundation of how we value assets. The land's worth is derived entirely from its preservation rather than its extraction.
And that is a perfect lens for you, the listener, to view this through as we wrap up our deep dive. We trace this remarkable timeline, starting with the strategic takeover of a rowdy tavern by Quaker twins in 1869.
Shifting to the climbing explosion of the 1930s.
Right, and culminating in the 1963 legal masterstroke that locked the mountain away from the open market forever. It's a story of protecting what matters.
Which leaves us with a necessary question to turn inward. We've dissected the legal and philosophical mechanisms the Smiley family built to protect the Shawangunks.
Yeah.
But consider your own landscape.
Yeah.
If you possess something truly invaluable, whether it's a physical family heirloom, a community initiative, or a set of deeply held principles, what mechanism would you construct to protect it from the inevitable pressures of time and compromise? What is the mountain ridge in your own life that you would engineer so perfectly and lock away so permanently that even you couldn't sell it?